Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good morning. It's time for the Book Show here on ABC Radio National. Ramona Koval with you. Today, a man who calls himself an urban poet, a poet of cafes and coffee shops, of time and space, with poems of numbers and fragments and postmodern and pre-modern and most modern poetry, and above all, an anarchist poet. Sounds a lot like Pio to me, and in fact, shortly, Pio will read from his work, and probably I should warn you there might be strong language involved. And later we'll hear what Don Anderson thinks of a new collection of John Updike's essays called Due Considerations. And in first person today, Richard Woolcott reading All Hail Liberia Hail, an extract from his book Undiplomatic Activity. But first, an update from the Dmitry Nabokov files. Now, listeners might remember we had a discussion earlier this year about the conundrum facing Vladimir Nabokov's son, about whether he'll carry out his father's wish to destroy a manuscript called The Original of Laura. Having kept the literary world in a state of suspense for years, he's finally announced that he is prepared to save it from destruction. According to a blog in The Guardian, the 73-year-old Dmitry has told Der Spiegel magazine that his father would not want his son to suffer any more over this dilemma. From his winter home in Palm Beach, reports the blog, Dmitry justified his decision by saying, "I'm a loyal son and thought long and seriously about it. Then my father appeared before me and said, with an ironic grin, 'You're stuck in a right old mess. Just go ahead and publish.'" He told the magazine that he'd made up his mind to do so. And in an email to the Book Show, he says he will gladly speak to us, but in a few days, when I have time to take a deep breath after a truly chaotic period. By then I should be able to say more about pub details, that's publication details. Well, we're not holding our breath, Dmitry. I once described him as undoubtedly the best poet in the title's office. Pio started writing poems about work and street life and migrant life and sex, and later wrote more concrete poems using numbers, which are pretty hard to talk about on the radio, but if anyone can, I reckon it's him. Welcome to the Book Show, Pio.
Thank you.
Well, this is the occasion of your new book, Big Numbers, a new and selected work, and I thought we might talk about your work by reading new and selected poems. Of course, you grew up in hamburger and gambling and sly grog shops in Fitzroy in inner Melbourne. And I think that's the setting for the first two poems in this book. Why don't you read them for us?
I tell you one story. It's not easy to learn. Maybe I'm not good enough to say you all this. Doesn't matter. Never mind. Let me to try. It's not cost you nothing. Doesn't like? Doesn't like. Grown up, get fucked, see you, that's all. Sorry not to talk to you proper way, but everybody mouth have talk, think something, talk, is the story of the life. Town. They come over to the counter while I'm bobbing up and down, mopping floors, washing cups and giving change. 3, 4, 6, 8, and 2 makes 10. Town. And whether I like it or not, they go on half-cocked about something I'm not even remotely interested about, like who Aristotle was or how their son's getting on. So I'll go on mopping floors, washing cups and giving change. 3, 4, 6, 8 and 2 makes 10. Ta. I mean, I don't have to stand there being polite. The shop's only a front for all the drinking and gambling that goes on in the back. Shit him, my father says. Utena perasi. Who ever heard of anyone making money out of selling hamburgers and coffee in Gertrude Street? So I'll go on mopping floors, washing cups and giving change. 3, 4, 6, 8 and 2 makes 10. Ta. Sometimes, though, a word or a phrase will grab me by the shirt and slam me up against the wall of the jukebox. So I'll scribble something down. Sometimes the words, sometimes the tone, sometimes the brow. I was for short time SP bookie, 90 convict, against the law, can't gone against the law. Mother, father, he's like to have love for the kids, but kids can't give, doesn't like the other day, while I was cleaning out the fridge, I heard one of the Greek men say, they let me, if I wants to. So I scribbled it down, a quick Picasso of sorts, because I was busy at the time. They lets me, if I wants to. But the more I thought about it, turning it over and over in my head like a haiku, they lets me, if I wants to, the more and more it started to sound like bullshit. I mean, I don't think anyone is going to let him. Not with an accent like that. No way. That accent's his passport to Ford's or GMH, not the world. No way. So I went on mopping floors, washing cups and giving change. 3, 4, 6, 8 and 2 makes 10. Ta. That is, until now, when I thought just how tragic that was. 3, 4, 6, 8 and 2 makes 10. Ta.
You saw a richness in the language of migrants, a richness that was usually lampooned in mainstream society.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, dialect writing has been used traditionally in Australia to send people up, whether it was the Irish or the Aboriginals or the Polacks or the Jews, during the bulletin times. Dialect was restricted for cartoons. And in fact, I did some investigation into dialect writing in Australia, and Kenneth Slessor, Australia's great modernist poet, wrote an essay saying it is inadmissible that the Garbo from Willamaloo could write poetry in dialect. Inadmissible, which I just found was the most amazing statement in Australian literature. And I think that's partly why we don't have a kind of dialect writing of Aboriginals until Kath Walker or Ujuru Nunnuknuckle comes along in 65, with critics refusing to even sign their names to reviews of her stuff, saying that the language was running her. She was not running the language. So I think sort of dialect writing has been sort of a thorn in Australian literature for a very long time.
So, dialect writing, I mean, when did you begin to think of this as poetry, as the words making music for you?
Well, what happened is I was in the shop, just like that poem Ta, and I was writing a poem, and a bloke came into the shop and asked me what I was doing. I said I was writing a poem, and he said, and I quote, "Don't you tell them truth, they doesn't believe you." And I thought there was no way to write that down in proper English except in the English that he was saying it in. And so I started writing it down. In fact, my first book, Fitzroy Brothel, people at work told me that I couldn't be a poet because I couldn't spell. So at the back of the book I wrote, fuck the spelling, you know. And I think that's quite prophetic, you know, in terms of my later development. Because I needed the language, I needed the vocabulary, I needed the spelling to be able to depict the universe that I lived in. And academia was not accepting, and not only academia, but literature, you know, sort of modernism and postmodernism and all those trends that were running through Australian culture, you know, wouldn't allow that kind of writing. Just like Kenneth Slessor said, it's inadmissible.
Well, you were banging against this door that was closed to you.
I was screaming it down.
And all the times you were working at the titles office, Are you still working at the titles office?
Yes, I am. I'm a draftsman. And the advantage of working was that I was able to free myself up to write anything I wanted. I mean, if I wanted to swear in my writing, I could. If I wanted to put visual poems in, things, the kind of poetry that's not acceptable within the mainstream or not considered literature. I mean, it's inadmissible. You know, Kenneth Slessor keeps coming up in this conversation. But it freed me up. Was I found a lot of people when I was growing up, you know, wanted to go on the dole and sort of bum on the beach and that kind of thing. But I couldn't. I mean, my mother was schizophrenic. My father was a gambler, come out of Fitzroy. It was very difficult just to sort of slum it through life.
Well, you'd started being in the slums. It's hard to slum it. It's not attractive, is it?
No, it's exactly right.
For kids like us who grew up in poverty, I suppose, the idea of the artist in poverty is not very attractive.
It's a very bad job description. You know, I think Romanticism gave poetry a really bad time. I think you need Romanticism, but I think you have to drop it like a hot cake very quickly. Otherwise, it swamps you and it takes over everything you write.
So as a draftsman in the title's office, you were drawing up drawings. There's a bit of mathematics involved.
Yes, there was. Yeah, there's quite a bit of mathematics in terms of survey work. We check and the legal and mathematical accuracy of documents and that kind of stuff. And so when I was at Collingwood Tech, they basically were streamlining us for the factory, as factory fodder. And I converted over to Fitzroy High because I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I certainly didn't want to be in a factory. And so when I went to Fitzroy High, I got a kind of enough sort of ideas and discipline to get an office job as opposed to a factory job. And that held me in good stead, basically. And it freed me right up, which was, you know, so important in my life. And like I said, you know, I can bring out my own books. I don't have to rely on writing about applications for grants and for pats on the back and that kind of stuff. Because a lot of the pats on the back and stuff come after you've done something, not before, you know.
Well, I wondered whether it was a good place for a poet. You've answered that, in that it allows the poet to be a poet because it gives you the support you need. But then I thought, is there much poetry in the title's office?
Oh, yeah. I mean, not just in the title's office, but I think sort of in offices. I did a magazine with a bunch of people, about four or five of us actually, called 9 to 5, which was a workers' magazine. And, it became the biggest poetry magazine in the country, 3,000 copies towards the end, 3,300 copies towards the end. And, you know, we were giving it away and people were taking it onto the shop floor. We had 126 different occupations, people from different occupations writing about their work. It went for 5 years. It was a fantastic experiment. But the interesting thing is basically the bohemians and the literati and the academy ignored it. Which is just absolutely astounding. And it's actually the beginning of performance poetry in Australia, and, you know, perhaps the greatest movement in Australian literature as a movement since the Jindawarra backs. But no one's interested. No one talks about it. No one's investigated. They're still stuck in 1968 with the small magazine explosion, and as though it was the beginning of everything. It wasn't. I mean, there are currents in Australian literature that go, you know, really quite deep, and they're not being investigated or considered as literature. I mean, I've been writing for 38 years, and you know, some critical reviews of my work have not come through. I mean, there've been one or two, three essays, and that's about it. The rest have been reviews, and the popular media or the popular imagination has been interested in my stuff, but academia seems to need the another academic to build on, and of course no one started, so no one's building on my kind of current.
Well, I'm speaking with Pyo about his new book, Big Numbers, New and Selected Poems, and you're on the book show with me, Ramona Koval, on ABC Radio National. Read for me the poem called Mimo, which looks like it comes out of the title's office. A bit of poetry from the title's office. 112, I believe.
All right.
Tell me about...
What happened was that when the office started getting photocopy machines, which weren't, you know, they were quite new technology when, you know, I came along. As soon as the photocopy machine came, people started photocopying off memos and sending them around everywhere, basically to protect themselves, I think, you know, saying, well, I did tell you, you know, it was in a memo. Yeah. And so these memos kept coming around, which was a new thing in the office. And one particular one came around, and I was absolutely stunned by it. So I kind of lampooned it a bit. It's almost like found poem, but I've tweaked it all over the place. Memo. A bomb threat will inevitably come as a shock. If you receive one, don't let on. Keep the caller talking. Ask him or her when the bomb will explode, where it is, what it looks like, and what will cause it to explode. Ask the caller their name and how old they are. Take particular notice of their accent, Israeli German, Spanish Russian, and to their tone, angry, drunk, calm, excited. If you happen to know who they are, don't let on. Don't blurt out, hey, is that you, Bob? Just keep them talking. Listen to background noise. A train whistle could be a vital clue. When the caller has finished, don't hang up. Keep calm and write in clear, legible script, "We're going to be bombed," and then hand it to your supervisor. He'll know what to do. If the order to evacuate is not given, open all the doors and windows to lessen the effect on property damage, and then go back to your desk and keep working. That poem is got an interesting quality to it, because when I first wrote it, it was very, very funny in that it was a send-up of bosses, the whole administration and everything. But since 9/11, with the bombing of the towers in the States and stuff, the poem took on a totally different meaning. It had a kind of an impending tragedy and forewarning and all that. So although the poem didn't change as such, the content text had changed, and therefore the content had changed. And so the poem, like I said, when I first started reading it, had every line, it had people in stitches. And then after 9/11, it became a very somber poem.
Isn't that interesting?
It's a real indication of just how context can change the content.
What about the poem called Schizophrenia, 154? Read that one to me. You mentioned that your mother was schizophrenic.
Yeah. Schizophrenia. She tells me to tell them thank you. She tells me to tell them thank you. We're sitting outside in the courtyard of an own-your-own flat. It's a beautiful day. You could almost own your own life. It's that beautiful. So she tells me to tell them thank you, because I'm writing everything down, and what she says goes. So she tells me to tell them thank you. I say, if she tells me to tell them thank you again, no one will believe me. Even a priest gets tired of saying amen all day. So she tells me to tell them that she extends her thanks to all the important people in the world who told her what to do for so long, and that whenever we use their name in the house, it's always with the utmost respect and courtesy. Then she tells me to tell them thank you, and that her son is writing all this down, because the Germans came and closed down her school, so she never learnt to write very well. Then she tells me to tell them she's a very sick woman waiting to get well. I tell her I'll be writing all this up in English, because my Greek's not too good. She says, Of course. Of course. I have to.
It's a hard one for you to read.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Taking care of someone else is really hard work, you know.
Especially when they've taken care of us.
Yes, of course, yeah. I'm amazed you picked that one, actually.
Why?
Oh, well, it's, you know, I don't read a lot of very, very, very personal poems, you know, like, you know, part of my... I mean, all my poems are about my biography, ultimately, but some poems are kind of, you know, really close to the edge on in that respect, you know, so I don't read a lot of those kind of poems. I mean, in this book, I've got also poems about my schooling and stuff like that, which I don't normally read out. I always think people are bored to hear about how you grew up, you know, because I wrote about 200 poems about how good I was in the early days, and it was fantastic because I was able to take the I out of the poem, and it wasn't about me. It was all about looking at the universe and looking at language and kind of objectifying the universe that I lived in with all my emotions, with all my biography, everything attached to it. But poems about, you know, kind of personal sort of emotions like my mother, my father and stuff, I kind of keep out. Like my father in this book, which was quite amazing, really, my mother and father actually came into this book because I was taking stuff out of all the different manuscripts, mainly unpublished. and in my father, he took, you know, there's about 5-6 poems in this book about him paying off the police and sort of preparing, you know, dressing up in a suit to go and see the police to pay them off so that they could leave the shop alone, you know, and this kind of stuff. So, but I don't read those kind of poems out, you know. It's a hard one.
I'm speaking with Pio on the book show here on ABC Radio National. You've moved in this collection from writing about the way people speak around you to your own life, and then you went into using numbers and your relationship with mathematics. Mm. You know, you have poems which are really a block of twos or threes, there's a poem called Cloud. I was on Cloud 9, and there's basically lines of zeros with occasional nines in the shape of a sort of cloud. What moved from the words to the numbers?
One of the things that hasn't been brought up in a lot of ethnic writing is the relationship between academic ability and the migrant experience. My name is Pi O. Pi is a mathematical symbol. It's also a Greek symbol, but it's also a mathematical one.
Was Pi O for Pangelis?
No, it's just Pi.
But no, but that was your original name, wasn't it?
No, well, hard to work out an original name. But
oh, right. You don't, I can't believe you're shy about your original name. Well, you don't talk about it.
Well, I don't know, but my initials are Pi O, and the relationship between the circle, which is the O, with Pi, which is the mathematical symbol, and so mathematics has been with me all the time. But in terms of the migrant experience, the academic ability and performance was important because we were the great white hope. You know, we were the ones who were going to sort of become doctors and solicitors and all these important people in society so that we could pull ourselves out of the slum and poverty and oppression. Mathematics was, an important tool and actually permeates all my work. Like even that poem Tar with the 2, 4, 3, you know, 6, yeah. 8. I mean, I'm actually counting out the money.
The money.
And so mathematics was just another dialect, if you like, another language. And because, I haven't sort of allowed myself to be pigeonholed as an ethnic writer, but I'm an urban writer. I write about cities, I write about the street, I write about the world I live in, and mathematics is part of that. And in particular, it's actually part of the migrant experience. But, you know, ethnics don't go talking about that. You know, ethnics want to talk about, you know, their latest ritual at home or something, which is fine. I mean, it's not to belittle that in its own right, but that's where they seem to be stuck. You know, what kind of food do you have? You know, what kind of dancing do you have? But it's not what has the impact of academia has had on you and it's your relationship to that. So my relationship to mathematics was to take mathematics into poetry and poetry into mathematics. And, of course, that goes back to Pythagoras, who marries the two, you know, in ancient Greece.
So the latest work, I mean, if the latest work is the work at the end, mm-hmm. that seems to have been even more on another trajectory where it's more and more graphic and sometimes without numbers, but, you know, with pictures.
Well, the visual
poetry. They're sort of pictograms.
Yeah, that kind of visual poetry, concrete poetry as it's called. And in the end of the book, you know, I've got some Greek and Chinese ones because I fell in love with the Chinese ideogram very early in my career, and all my books have actually got them. And also some Greek visual poetry too. So I've been going into that. But also towards the end of the book is a long poem which I'm still writing called The Everything Poem. I've got extracts from it. And The Everything Poem is the actual information superhighway coming at you at 1,000 miles an hour with information, seemingly irrelevant information, that coalesces into a concept or a portrait or some kind of poem. So numbers from not on the screen but inside the computer. And then on the screen is the information itself. So I'm actually playing with the new technology and playing with the computer and the microchip and the floppy disk and all that, and bringing it into poetry as a valid form, just like the sonnet was a valid form for, say, Shakespeare. The number poems are also a valid form for our world to describe it, and the information superhighway is really part of that. Most people's notion of computer poetry is to just put up whatever you got on the white page up on the screen, and that's computer poetry. And that's crap, you know, that's so simplistic.
How can you perform, though, this kind of poetry? You can't really, can
well,
you?
Well, yeah, you can. I mean, I'll do a I'll do a number poem. I've got to find it first. But there's some sound poetry that, like, for instance, you know, there's the one called Curiosity, and it's a series of zeros with a nine, and then an eight, and then a decimal point. And curiosity killed a cat, nine lives. It stands up in the hourglass shape, you know, just like a cat might sit up, and it gets shot with a bullet, which is the decimal point. I mean, that's just the visual poem of that.
But it's hard to perform, though, isn't it?
Well, it depends on what your notion of perform is.
Yes, it does.
You know, if you mean, can it be read out?
Yeah, but it can be read out in an interesting way. I'm not sure about that. But I was really thinking, you can't perform these ideograms.
No, you can't perform those ones.
So that must be a bit hard for a performer like you to sit with these ideograms and allow them to do their own work.
Well, no, I just put them on the screen using a PowerPoint, because PowerPoints are also a new tool, and visual poetry is the beginning of the computer poetry on the screen. It uses the visual field by which to project language and play with it, just like an artist would.
But you know what? I'm amazed that PowerPoint has come into poetry like this, and this is a good thing, because I'm always a big critic of PowerPoint. But I can see where it could be useful in this particular case. But look, finally, when you look at this book, Big Numbers, New and Selected Poems, what do you think when you look at it?
Well, to tell you the truth, I honestly feel like there's nothing in it.
Why?
It's 432 pages, and I've got no idea. There's this, like, once the book came from the printer, I sort of felt like, I did a calculation. It will cost the reader $1 per 10 pages, and that it's about 10 pages per year of writing. So
your whole life is in this. What do you mean it's nothing?
No, but it just feels like, I don't know. It just, maybe it's because the object is such a small package, if you get what I mean, that I don't...
And a life is such a big thing. But it's small on the outside, but big on the inside, Pio.
Thank you.
It's called Big Numbers, New and Selected Poems. The publisher is
Collective Effort Press.
And Pio, thank you so much for being on the book show today.
Thank you for having me.
You're with The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval. Now, few people in America can compare with John Updike in the art of short-form non-fiction writing, essays, reviews, critiques and introductions. Updike's prodigious output over more than half a century has periodically been brought together in published collections, and the sixth of these, called Due Considerations, has been keeping Don Anderson very busy and out of mischief. Here's Don with his impressions of this exceedingly large volume.
Over the summer, I read John Updike's Due Considerations, his 700-page collection of his essays and reviews from the last 7 years, and his sixth such volume since 1965, in a manner that I suggest no one else, not even the author, though perhaps his copy editor, did. That is, I read it from go to woe, from alpha to omega, from page 1, that's a Roman one, to page 709. This is not, I imagine, an ideal fashion in which to read the book. Rather, one would use the 30-page index to pursue authors or topics that might interest one, as one would have encountered these picked-up pieces, principally in The New Yorker or the New York Review of Books, or the New York Times. Due Considerations and Updike's other six volumes of criticism are, it ought to be noted, the work of his left hand, so to speak. He is, of course, the author of more than 20 novels, 7 volumes of short stories, collections of poems, and a fascinating memoir, Self-Consciousness, which may be intended to head off biographies. No consideration of the American novel in the second half of the 20th century is complete without Updike, particularly of his Rabbit Angstrom books. Updike was born in 1932 in Shillington, Pennsylvania, and educated at Harvard and in Oxford, England. From 1955 to 1957, he was a member of the staff of The New Yorker and has contributed to it ever since. His novels have won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, the American Book Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Rosenthal Award, and the Howells Medal. But laurels do not pay the rent or the alimony bills, thus reviewing. I once read somewhere that Updike's house contained 3 studies, one in which to write novels, one in which to write reviews, and I forget the third thing, as Henry Carr said in Stoppard's Travesties. Perhaps it was for paying bills, for The New Yorker is rumoured to pay very handsomely. The New Yorker seems to Updike not only the best general magazine in America, but perhaps the best that America ever produced. Without it, in the 20th century, every literate person's sights would have been lowered. Like his host journal, Updike is an unashamed non-specialist. What he is opposed to may be suggested in his own words. The winds of deconstructionist theory that have dishevelled English departments since I was a student in one in the early 50s. In the USA, he says, discussions of how literature represents reality have been smothered beneath the arid fuss of politicised deconstruction. Like The New Yorker, and unlike such deconstructionist discourse, Updike's novels and essays are intensely readable, immensely pleasurable, yet disarmingly modest. The exercise of compassion, he says, by the writer and then by the reader, remains one of the novel's chief duties and complex pleasures. Updike is again and again a proponent of realism as of reality. Writing Contra Don DeLillo, he allows that this concept-driven writer has shown himself capable of realism's patient surfaces and saturation in personally verified detail. Again, Updike claims, we look to fiction for images of reality, real life rendered as vicarious experience with a circumstantial intimacy that more factual, explanatory accounts cannot quite supply. And again, of Margaret Atwood's Blind Assassin, he says, as is the way with reality. Well, deconstruct that. Perhaps it may be said of novelist critics that they are in their criticism, consciously or unconsciously, writing about themselves, about their own practices and prejudices. When Updike speaks, apropos his historical novel Buchanan Dying, of his obligation to truth, to the facts of history, what truth can be higher than what actually did happen, he asks, we feel a connection with his profound disagreement with Dr. O's Ragtime, some 300 pages previously. This tells us much about Updike, but not necessarily a lot about Dr. O. There are no less than 62 book reviews in these pages, and I, for one, am grateful to Updike for having read and offered plot outlines of all these books for me, even when I had, or came to, read them myself. I appreciate his plain style, though I did encounter the word farraginous not once but twice. Speaking of farrago, it might be said that Updike's book is just that, a Gallimaufry, a Miscellany, a Mingle-Mangle, Potpourri, Salmagundi, an Omnium Gatherum. There are book reviews of Americans and Europeans, Walter Abish to W.B. Yeats. There are introductions to others' books, to Thoreau's Walden, to Henry James' The Portrait of a Lady, to the selected poems of the unfashionable Carl Shapiro, for example. There are several essays on art and artists, especially where those pieces can be illustrated by black and white reproductions. It is difficult to avoid the impression that Updike has been amply rewarded for just having a good time, and his prose communicates that. It might be said of Updike, as he says of Frank Kermode, that his analyses enlarge rather than diminish, heal rather than dissect. To conclude upon a parochial note, in all these 650-plus pages, only four Australians are mentioned, two, Germaine Greer and Bruce Petty, but in passing. Robert Hughes Goya is afforded a review, with Updike showing familiarity with The Fatal Shore. Peter Carey, however, is accorded not one, not two, but three reviews, all of novels published since 2000. What do three of these four distinguished Australians have in common? They are, to use a word that Carey does not care for, expatriates, metropolitan critics, to use a term appropriated by Clive James. As it is said in a Frank Morehouse story, when local poets are explaining Australian literary magazines to a visiting American, Mianjin, it's Aboriginal for rejected by the New Yorker.
Very funny. Don Anderson, who's going to send us to our dictionaries. And John Updike's sixth volume of essays and criticism called Due Consideration is published in Australia by Hamish Hamilton, available through Penguin. Now, if you want to hear this program again tonight at midnight, or go to the website abc.net.au/rn/bookshow. Have a fantastic day. See you.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.